Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
From Dog Works Training Centers, Professional Canine Training Center in Denver, Colorado, this is the Dog Doctor. Committed to families and their dogs to build lifelong and fulfilling relationships. Visit our website at dogdoctorradio.com. The Dog Doctor is part of Twine Group Media and syndicated worldwide on blogtalkradio.com. Now here is your host, Dr. Robert Forto, the Dog Doctor.
Hello and welcome, everybody. My name is Robert Forto, and you are listening to the Dog Doctor Radio Show coming to you live from Denver Dog Works. I am here today with my host, Michelle Forto. How are you?
I'm doing well.
Had a little frog in my throat there for just a second, but we have a very special show today. We're talking to producer Nicholas Goodman and dog trainer extraordinaire Kyle Warren and their brand new film, Canine Instinct. We were privileged to preview the film about a month and a half ago and wrote a review for those guys. What do you think of the film, Michelle?
You know, for a documentary, which you're a huge fan of, I thought it was put together pretty well. I don't care for documentaries, but this one captured my attention, not just because I am a dog trainer, but because I was interested in what they were trying to get across to people.
You know, what I found most interesting was the homespun aspect of it. It wasn't flashy and, you know, in-your-face type stuff. It was something that not only a dog trainer may watch, but just somebody that is very interested in the world of dogs could really gain some insight and knowledge from Canine Instinct.
You know, absolutely, and I was expecting it to be, and please don't be insulted, but another spinoff of Cesar Millan, and I was very impressed at the way that Kyle carries himself and portrays dog training. It's very much what you and I are used to, and our dog training approach over the years has been very similar. I'm actually looking forward to getting in and reading his book and figuring out the Warren method and seeing how much it compares and contrasts to the Forto method.
There you go. So we're going to get to those guys in just a second. Before we do, what is going on at Denver Dog Works?
You know, I've got quite a few boarding trains this summer, and it's keeping me quite busy with our Camp Works. And that program, for whatever reason, seems to be our most popular right now. And I'm enjoying that because it gives me an opportunity to train people's dogs that they just don't have the time to do it themselves. The biggest drawback about a boarding train is that the people don't learn how to interact with their dogs. And I try to take as much time as possible with them to show them how to interact properly with their dogs. But, you know, here in Denver, it's such a fashion statement right now to be involved in training your dog or having your dog trained or so-and-so's my dog trainer. We're really starting to see dog training as a fashion trend here in Denver, and I'm becoming a little bit concerned about that.
I agree with that. You know, we were watching an episode of The Dog, The Bounty Hunter yesterday. I know that this is a dog training show, but we might as well mention it. And what I found interesting is the lead guy, Dog, went out and bought his wife one of those little teeny Papillons strictly for an accessory. He even said so on the show. And I found that pretty amazing that is how so many people think of the little dogs.
You know, he did say that, but he also said that it was a way to bring out the niceness of her, which I found quite compelling, actually. But, you know, a lot of people view dogs that way as status symbols and trends and fashion statements and things like that. But what I'm seeing a trend in here in Denver, especially, is the fact that training is no longer what you and I grew up with, what training was. Training meant that you were doing something with your dog and you were gaining from the situation and your dog was gaining from the situation. It was all about respect. And what I'm seeing now has nothing to do with respect and more to do with, well, I'm getting training because my neighbor got training and apparently that's what we're supposed to do now.
So there you go. So we're also fresh off the plane from Alaska, and we're going to make the big announcement on tomorrow's show on Mushu Huskies about the future home of our Iditarod team, Team Aneke. So pay attention to that. You can listen to it right on this same site, blogtalkradio.com/dogworks. Michelle, would you like to introduce our guests, please?
Sure. Nicholas Goodman and Kyle Warren from Canine Instinct. Are you there?
Yes. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, Michelle.
Robert.
We're here.
Hi. Could you guys do me a favor and possibly speak up a little bit?
Sure. Absolutely. hi, this is Nicholas Goodman. I'm the producer and director of the film, and I'm here with Kyle Warren. Say hi, Kyle.
Hey, this is Kyle Warren. I was the guy under the microscope in the film, and hi, everybody.
Nice to meet you guys over the air. It was a pleasure to watch your film. So nicely done, Nicholas. I got to commend you on that. I know you and I have talked several times over the phone during this process, and I have to say, I don't know what other work you've done in film, but this is a good one.
Well, thanks very much, Robert. It's very gratifying to hear you say that. I appreciate it. I want to thank you also for the wonderful review that you wrote and posted on your website. I think that you really, you know, you got what I intended to portray in the film, and that's also very, very gratifying for me as a filmmaker.
You're more than welcome. So before we get into our interview with Kyle, let's talk a little bit to you, Nick, about why you wanted to do a film like this, what compelled you to do so, and give us a little history of what you've done in the past.
Sure. Well, I mean, in the past, I've done a couple of other independent films that have done the film festival circuit, and one was a funny short film that I did that actually got a fair amount of notice at the time, was absolutely unrelated to dogs. It was a little thing called Swing Blade. Was a parody short film combining the independent film Swingers and Sling Blade, where the lead character from Sling Blade tried to find a date on the Swingers bar scene. These are all independent films from the late 90s, and that got a lot of attention. And I've directed commercials for businesses in the area here in upstate New York. And I'm always looking for stories, you know, to make my next film. And I was, you know, trying to raise money to do a fairly large documentary project about science and technology, and was having, you know, some difficulty raising the funds, because as I kept researching it, I realized that I would need, you know, some significant money to do it properly. And I met Kyle one evening at dinner, and, you know, we just exchanged our stories and we're chatting, and I was struck by him and what he did and who he was and how he presented himself. And, you know, we just had a lovely dinner. It wasn't anything, you know, business-oriented. It was through friends. And afterwards, I just kept thinking about the conversation that we had and who he was, and I thought, huh, you know, I'm looking for something to do. This is something that maybe I can do that would be fairly simple to do, that I wouldn't need to have investors or anything like that. I could just grab my camera and go do it myself. And so I called Kyle, and I'll admit, at first he was quite reluctant to do it because he's, you know, he likes his life just the way it is and didn't want any interruptions or distractions and, you know, wasn't seeking any kind of, you know, publicity or anything. And, you know, I just said, well, I'm interested in you, and I'm interested in what you do and how you work with dogs. It's something that I actually don't know very much about. And that's actually, as a documentary filmmaker, a good way to jump into something. So you're sort of a, you know, a tabula rasa, a clean slate. You know, you go in and you learn as you shoot and as you interview your subject, and you let the material reveal itself. So that's what happened.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, that's it. That's what I did.
So as Michelle mentioned at the intro, there are, you know, the most popular dog trainer in the world is obviously Cesar Millan. So what is different, you know, with your film compared to The Flash of Hollywood and, you know, everything that goes with a huge production like something that Cesar does or some of the other quote-unquote TV dog trainers? Why is your story special, and why should somebody invest, you know, the 19 or 20 or whatever dollars it costs to buy Canine Instinct?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, you know, I like to sort of say that the film, you know, reveals the portrait of a guy who's almost like the antidote to Cesar Millan. The, you know, he's a very different approach to dog training. I'm not a dog trainer, and I'm not a professional dog handler, so I really can't speak to the you know, training aspect of it, but my takeaway, my impression of Kyle and what he does is give people real skills that they can use themselves, very practical, simple, basic skills that can be used over and over and over again that will get them to have a better relationship with their dog. Whereas my impression of The Dog Whisperer, and I happen to really like The Dog Whisperer as a show, you know, I think it's very entertaining. I think Cesar Millan is an interesting character, but he's very unique in and of himself. You know, he uses his, you know, weird sort of sounds and, you know, makes hand gestures and he, to me anyway, tries to act like a dog. Like to try to actually be the alpha dog in a pack situation. And, you know, one of the things that, you know, Kyle says very clearly in our film is that, you know, he's not trying to be like a dog, you know. He's trying to get people to be the best person they can be in their relationship with their dog. And I think that's the fundamental difference.
I agree with that. So how long did the film take to make? Where was it shot? You know, give us a little bit of outline of what the film setting is before we get into our interview with Kyle.
Sure. Well, the film took 3 years to make from the first night that we had that conversation to today, basically. It's been 3 years. And it all takes place in, you know, the upstate New York area, Catskill Mountains. It's very picturesque and beautiful rolling hills and green trees and you know, water and blue sky. And, of course, that's also a big contrast to, you know, a lot of the dog training shows you see on television, which are all very urban. And, you know, I just filmed Kyle doing his daily routine and, you know, tried to focus in on several dogs to go through the training process. And of course, I quickly learned that, you know, as we all know in life, you know, things happen that you don't expect and you know, dogs drop out and new ones appear. And you know, so it was not what I intended initially. I thought I'd track like one or two or three, you know, different special dogs through the whole thing and that there'd just be a little profile like that. And it didn't turn out that way. And of course, different things happened during the course of, you know, our filming where Kyle's life changed. And so he started doing more work with search and rescue, canine search and rescue. And so that became a big part of the film as well. And so, you know, it's a portrait of Kyle's life as a dog trainer. It's not an expose. You know, we're not trying to get into the nitty-gritty of what makes Kyle tick. That's not what this is about. It's really, you know, about dogs and a man who has a life with dogs, and hopefully other people can, you know, appreciate that and get from that something, I hope, that's a little bit bigger than just a man with his dogs. It's an approach to living. It's a way that, you know, to me, the way Kyle lives his life, and of course, you know, he's here. I don't know if he's ever heard me say this to him or not, but there's something for us all to be gained by his philosophy and his approach to living. And it's exemplified in how he is able to get respect and have a mutual relationship with canines, with dogs. It's a lot easier with dogs, I think, in a lot of ways than it is from person to person. And so I think that there's something really useful there as well. So, you know, not only does he help us learn to you know, live a better life with our own pets and our own, you know, canine companions, but I think there's also some lessons to be learned of how we might get along with each other.
And is the film available now? If it's not, when will it be available and how do we purchase?
Yeah, the film is available. It's available from the film's website, which is canineinstinct-movie.com. And hopefully, you know, at some point there'll be a link perhaps posted on, you know, your website so your listeners can just click on it. But if they search Canine Instinct Movie or Canine Instinct Kyle, you know, the website will just come up. And they can click on it and buy the DVD there. And, you know, we would love people to see it and also, you know, to join our Facebook group and to post their comments so we can actually start a dialogue about how people are viewing the film, what they get from it, and, you know, answer questions, that sort of thing.
Is it available on Amazon? And if it's not, will it be?
It's not available on Amazon right now. We're still applying to film festivals, and there are certain restrictions for some festivals where if you have broad distribution on those various platforms like Amazon or iTunes, you can't apply to film festivals anymore. But it will be, as soon as that's done, probably within the next few months.
And what about clips of the movie on YouTube or something like that?
Yeah, we've got a few clips up there now. You can the clips are on the YouTube channel is Canine Instinct Film, all one word. Excuse me. You can also get there through the website. We have clips, the same clips posted on the movie website, and it also clicks through to our YouTube channel.
Gotcha. So, Nicholas, feel free to jump in anytime if you have anything to add while we're talking to Kyle. I really appreciate it, and we will make sure that we do our job to promote the film as much as we possibly can. These shows are available forever. Of course, they are on iTunes and through the Internet, and you know how that works. So people can listen to this anytime, and I'll make sure to send you over a link as soon as we get it posted on Saturday. So I appreciate your time, and again, feel free to jump in anytime. You're listening to the Dog Doctor Radio Show, part of Twine Group Media, and brought to you by Denver Dog Works. My name is Robert Forto, and I'm here with my co-host, Michelle, and we're talking to Nicholas Goodman and dog trainer Kyle Warren about their brand new film, Canine Instinct. And I'd like to bring Kyle Warren up. Kyle, are you there?
Yes, I am. Hi, Robert.
Hi, how are you? So if you could, we got a pretty good history of what's going on behind the film. So tell us who you are, what you're about, and what got you started in this crazy world of dog training.
Sure, absolutely. Just a moment before I do that, I want to say to Michelle, where do I sign up? I love your attitude and everything that you said in your opening. And so how did I get started? When I was a young boy, I would say around 10 years old, we got our first hunting dog, a German short-haired pointer. And I wasn't really into hunting, and my father and I didn't really have any real bonding activities or anything. And I come from a big farmer hunter type family, and so he figured, we might be able to find some connective joy in the realm of bird hunting. And so we got this dog as a pup, and I just completely fell in love with watching this dog work to the point of obsessive compulsive behavior. We never trained this dog anything, and that was one of the things that I found most remarkable, actually, was just this dog's pure, raw canine instinct for doing what it was highly bred to do for many decades. And this dog, Jesse, we had... I'll be 30 next month, and we got this dog again when I was 10 years old, and she lived to be almost 17. So this dog was in my life for a really long time, and she was really, basically, I guess, what spearheaded, my obsession. And then from the time I was, 10 years old to 15 years old, I was the kid in the rural/suburban neighborhoods and schools, training the teachers' dogs for free, working with my neighbors' dogs, going to shelters and spending some time there. I was a social kid, but a quiet kid, and working with people and their dogs is really kind of what brought me out of my shell. Unfortunately, when I was 16 years old, my mother had passed away. And at that time, I had already worked with several hundred dogs, just playing around and getting a feel for it, learning what the dogs basically felt was more successful methods for demonstrating the basics in hunting and stuff. And a lot of it was focused around bird dogs, because that's certainly where my initial passion was springboarded from. But when I was 16, I officially opened my business, which at that time, me as a 16-year-old labeled it the Pack of Northern Pride, which has transformed into Canine Instinct today. But I grew up on a small farm. We had pigs, cows, chickens, all that kind of stuff. And when I didn't want to take care of the farm animals anymore, my father didn't. You know, we had gotten rid of the farm animals, and I converted our barn, small barn, into a dog kennel. And I was, in high school at the time, involved in sports, and, you know, having already had kind of like a small network in the dog community, dogs just kept funneling through, you know, my barn. And I used to keep the dogs for like 6 weeks, work with them every day for various lengths of time, depending upon the dog, my time, and whatnot. And the owners came to me once a week to work with them. And I did that for about 4 years or so. Business was great. As Michelle pointed out, you know, the pros and cons to boarding training. Basically it proved to these people that I could do my job. It didn't necessarily mean they could do their job. That at that point, you know, I've been messing around with dogs for 8 or 9 years in the community, and had really already worked with, you know, 800-900 dogs in one-on-one situations. And my father said, Kyle, you got 13 dogs in our backyard. We got 3 acres. We got neighbors on both sides. You know, you got wheels. Use them. You know, start going to people's houses to do this stuff. So I took the show on the road, and very different kind of training, as you guys are well aware. Where, you know, you go to the student's house, you'll say one, maybe twice a week, and, you know, the dog's left with them, and, you know, you're doing an instructional, you know, situation with the owners and their dogs, giving them a little mini homework assignments, and there for them for technical and moral support, you know, in between the lessons on phone via email. And that basically is still what I do today. The range of what I teach certainly has continually expanded over the years. When I was a kid, I didn't really work with dogs with serious aggressive behaviors, nor did they seem to find me. People always ask me how I got into it. You know, I'm telling you chronologically how things happened, but I never really sought it out. It just I got obsessed with my own dog, and then things kind of just got attracted to me that way, and I was very, very fortunate. But today, you know, I do work with dogs with basic and advanced obedience. Obviously, those can be greatly defined, differently from trainer to trainer. I do work with dogs with an array of aggressive behavior, rehabilitation. I do versatile bird hunting, both land and water. I do work with search and rescue dogs. I have two operational dogs myself, and am the training officer for one of the two largest canine search and rescue teams in the state of New York. There's pretty much any kind of problem solving. I would say the only two things that I don't have any experience with, which certainly I hope in my lifetime I do have time to do and indulge in, is the world of agility, I'm a novice, and the world of sheep herding, I'm a novice. But besides those two things, there are not too many avenues of the canine's brain I have not flexed myself thoroughly in. And I do try to, you know, I do consider myself a naturalist, largely so, not in the sense of pride, but just out of a sense of fact. I've observed lots of different trainers and stuff, and what I've learned, and I'm sure you guys have as well, is even within your student base, you know, just because a person's had German Shepherds for 50 years doesn't mean that they're going to be a great dog handler. Experience can count, but doesn't necessarily mean it does, and I've worked with 17-year-old kids that are just phenomenal dog handlers based on their attitude, you know, even their athletic ability and just their ability to act on their feet. And that's more where I feel that I come from is, you know, I've had people over the years that have wanted to train with me for the purpose of being a trainer, and given the fact that, unfortunately, and I do mean unfortunately, that I work with a fair number of aggressive dogs, I've always been pretty strict as to which people I work with because, my experience, despite the fact I'm in my little bubble in upstate New York that I love so much, is like 98% of dog trainers around the world today, you know, or at least in this country, you know, utilize treats as a primary and ultimate motivator. And, you know, I'm pretty well versed, you know, through my experience and just how I, you know, feel I click with the dog and understanding the difference between, we'll say, I'll go, you know, as an exaggeration, but non-motivational obedience, where the handler is earning respect through a quality mechanical and emotional performance, versus working the dog, quote unquote, in drive, you know, i.e., using toys or food, which definitely has its benefits for teaching mechanical concepts and getting, you know, teaching a dog how to do something. But when push comes to shove, you know, I would say 8 out of 10 dogs, you know, if they have high prey drive and, you know, you're in the backyard or in the woods and the deer comes across and they're going to chase it and the dog's been 100% treat trained, I wouldn't necessarily bet a $100 bill that dog's going to respond reliably. Whereas, again, with the quality mechanical emotional performance that, you know, I'm always pounding into my students head, you know, how do you define consistency, you know, and the dog hearing, seeing, and feeling the same thing, and, you know, you influencing the dog's behavior, dog not influencing your behavior, but at the same time being, you know, very acutely aware to how the dog is feeling, how they have the same emotional spectrum as people, which also usually in turn means that, you know, dog and manipulator are synonymous terms. But, you know, that's the path of how I got here and kind of who I am and where I stand, you know, with where I've gotten today.
You know, Kyle, I'd like to thank you for the compliments first and foremost, but you make a very good point there about the fact that it doesn't matter how old you are and how many dogs you've had, you might not necessarily be the right handler for the dog you currently have. And we see that a lot in our business here in Denver. And, you know, it kind of rings true. There's plenty of times that I abuse my children and put them in classes and have them take dogs from people because they simply cannot handle their dogs. And my 12-year-old daughter will walk over and take the person, and we call it tandem training. This is how awful it is. I have her walk with the person, I don't care if it's a man or a woman, and she handles their dog and makes them copy exactly what she's doing, and lo and behold, in an hour, they're able to handle their dogs to where before they couldn't control their dog at all.
Yeah, no, I mean, I totally identify that with that, and, you know, that happens, you know, here as well all the time, and it's hard. I mean, certainly that's the reason why, you know, the treats, the prong collars, these no-pull harnesses, all these apparatuses and whatnot, you know, certainly are for the most part a substitute, you know, at times for handling ability or initial knowledge, you know, that a novice handler might have. And, you know, yeah, it happens all the time. And I'm sure I would think that you agree, Michelle, that, you know, most people are choosing their dogs, you know, based on looks, you know, and, you know, there's not too many, as many dog breed books as there are out there. You know, unfortunately, I think people are looking at the pictures more than all the print below them.
Well, yeah, I absolutely agree with that. I write a segment here for the stupidlittleexaminer.com newspaper called the Denver Dog Training Examiner, and I do a segment called Behind the Breed because I do breed referrals for people, and it's amazing to me how many people think, well, I'm going to get that dog, and it's not the dog for them, not just because of the breed, but because of the temperament. So, you know, Robert and I are trying to come up with ways to get people to understand that if they'll call us first, we can help them not only choose the right breed, but maybe the right temperament for what they're trying to do with their dog.
You know, Kyle, I have to commend you. You know, when I watched that first part of the film, I saw you in me every day. I do that same kind of stuff with aggressive dogs almost every day, and for some reason they do call us for those aggressive dogs. And when you live in a city of I don't know, 3 or 4 million people, there's a heck of a lot of people getting bit by dogs, and fortunately, I guess they call us, and pretty much my work is dealing with that situation you guys had in that first scene of breaking up the three dog fight and the clients just saying, wow, you're great, you know, you saved our entire household. So You know, I know exactly where you're coming from, and I think that the film portrays that pretty well, and I think a lot of people that do watch that will see exactly what we're talking about when we're dealing with these severe problems that we deal with on a daily basis. And I know we have a bunch of clips here, and I want to make sure that we get those in there. But before we do, Kyle, tell us a little bit about your book. I know you talk about it in the film, and it's also available for sale. Why did you write that, and who is it written for? Is it written for the regular guy, or is it written for dog trainers, or who?
So it is designed for for the novice dog owner, you know, that's trying to become a dog handler. I had started to say, I don't know how long you guys have been doing it, but as you go through time, you realize, we'll say being a good dog communicator, you learn better ways to communicate as time goes on. And I actually wrote that book, even though I'm, still early on in my career, I actually wrote that book 10 years ago when I was just 20 and my back had gone out. And I wrote that book in like 4 days. And it's a how-to. It covers all of our basic commands. There's 15 to 20 anecdotal stories in there. There's also how I recommend to be raising a puppy and whatnot, general information, a couple chapters on that. There's on my website, actually, the differences in the updates to the canine behavior notes, so to speak, that I would say I have evolved from over the past 10 years and 1,700 dogs later is on my website that was formerly in my book. But otherwise, everything in there is pretty much the nuts and bolts of the mechanical basics and a general outline for emotional performance and just getting people to kind of get in the dog's head a little bit. I'm working on a new book now that probably won't be out for another year or so. That's more based on actually what Michelle was talking about in the opener with what dog training actually is and how people have gotten away from that, I believe. More describing the relationship and going into kind of trying to categorize things. I mean, I'm sure you guys have trained thousands of dogs. And even though every dog's a little bit different, so to speak, you and I both know that you can kind of categorically slot them into probably 20 to 30 different personality types, so to speak. And I'd like to try to do something a little bit different with my experience and how I feel I can communicate with the dog and try to define some of those slots. And then the same thing for my people. You can kind of slot their personality types as well. And I think if people can be honest with themselves and or if they know themselves well, it'll be a really interesting read and very helpful for themselves and for me as their teacher as well. So that's one of my current projects that I'm working on.
So with that, let's set up our first clip about respect. I know that's kind of your philosophy there. So tell us a little bit about that, or would you like us to play it first and then talk about it?
Why don't you play it first? And I'd certainly love to say a couple things about that.
All right, here we go.
Good girl. Heel. Let's go, Max. Heel. That's a girl. Heel.
When we talk about earning respect from the dog, and I always emphasize earning in bold capital letters, you have to earn it from the dog. You can't beat it into him. You can't bribe him for it.
Good girl, Maggie.
I'm not a fan of the word obedience. Obedience just gives you the sense of physically making the dog do something mechanical. All right? It doesn't have anything to do with the concept of a relationship.
Maggie, sit.
You show them that you're capable of giving them guidance, providing physical control over them. You've taught them patience so they think before they act. And that's what we're working on with the way that we teach the dog. If you do possess those components in your relationship with a hierarchical creature such as a dog, why wouldn't they do everything that you ask and be happy to do so?
There you go, Kyle. Tell us a little bit about that clip there and what it's all about.
All right. That's a great segment, and that's one that I wanted to be chosen for this show, Because I do think that that is at the core of what we're trying to obtain, and one of the most misguided perceptions, you know, within the world of dog training. I try to avoid, when I'm talking to a potential student, I try to avoid using the word respect, because I feel that society has labeled the word respect as like a fear factor, intimidating, negative word or label. And that's very unfortunate. I love my people. I love my students. But they have huge, huge, huge hearts and are very guarded and or overprotective, most definitely of their four-legged kids, you know. And so when they hear that word in 2010, initially, I think more of them than not are a little intimidated themselves by when you say, like, you know, love, trust, and respect, and blah 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 blah. That becomes like a red flag to them before they get to know you and get to work with you and get the hands on. So that clip there is really articulates, you know, some of the core issues of how people perceive the concept of respect. And I think something that really defines some points here is you know, when you're earning it through, as I was saying before, mechanical and emotional concepts and consistency of hearing, seeing, and feeling the same thing. You know, that dog's going to view you not just as a Pez dispenser or a taxi service or a brute, but actually see that, you know, you're a leader with a plan. And, you know, any dog can assess, all leaders have goals. You know, you can put the dog on the mat in the same spot 10 times, then dog can see what you want. But does that leader, that potential leader, have a plan? And I think that's where the respect factor comes in. You know, if you're gonna break things down and say everything kind of drives back, you know, when you're working with dogs in this way, to like primal survival related stuff. You know, can this woman, you know, enable me to survive, you know, and in a functional, happy atmosphere?
Yeah. If I might jump in here for a second, I mean, to me, it's the kind of respect that, you know, you would have for a teacher that's really inspired you. Or, as Kyle just brought up in his example of, you know, let's say you're out, you know, hunting or fishing or hiking with your buddy and you get into a situation, you know, is that the kind of person that you want to be out in the woods with? And while those are human, you know, relationships, it's the same kind of thing where your dog is looking to you to have, you know, that you're showing leadership skills that they respect and admire. It's not about fear or intimidation.
You know, Kyle, you really kind of nail it. I ask my clients all the time, what's your plan? What do you want to do with your dog? And it's amazing how many blank stares I get back at me, and they really have no idea what they want to do with their dog, nor do they have any plan in mind for even just teaching a simple sit.
Yeah.
And I think that your film is really going to broaden the spectrum here as far as taking this fashionable dog training event that's going on right now and really turning it back into the reason why we have a dog in the first place. We want a companion. We want our best friend to hang out with us all day long. I train service dogs for people, and my primary focus is for psychiatric service work. And the biggest thing that those people need is exactly what you guys just described.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yep.
So, Kyle, with your work with search and rescue dogs, that is truly a teamwork effort between you and your dog, you know, the handler and the dog. And I can relate to that quite a bit. My first business, actually, way back in 1990, was called Northwest Lifeline, and we trained people how to work with search and rescue dogs. And we didn't do it in terms of doing the search and rescue work. It was about how to just handle dogs, and I was 18 years old, didn't have a clue what I was doing, but that was my first foray really into dog training. But the best way I can relate to this is doing mushing or sled dog work. And if you don't have that kinship or that relationship and that respect with your dogs, they're not going to pull for you. And in search and rescue work, they may or may not, you may or may not handle well for them. So can you tell us a little bit about that, and how that respect and that teamwork is so important when you're doing work with your dogs versus just the family pet that's sitting at your feet watching Monday Night Football?
Yeah, sure. I'll do the best I can to keep it brief and not lose you.
That's fine.
You know, the you're absolutely right. The connection, I mean, you know, across the board with everything, even the basics. But when you get into service work like that, you know, and you're into a really, really mentally strenuous task that requires a lot of physical endurance. There's a lot of energy that's going back and forth between you and this dog. That has nothing to do with you teaching him it even per se, but the experiencing of you, the experience between with you and that dog out in the field, that just happens. And when I'm out there, I have two dogs, as you saw in the film, Quox and Maya. And Quox, as an example, who's an area search dog. For you listeners that are probably much more familiar with how bird dogs would locate a bird, you know, by smelling its scent in the air, pinpointing it. That's kind of what Quox does for human scent, dead or alive. And he's trained that when he locates a subject which could be 500 yards away, depending upon the terrain and the scent conditions, and he's working off lead, obviously, he'll come back to me and he'll bark at me multiple times, basically saying, "I found him, I found him, I found him." I'll say, "Show me," and he'll guide me back to that individual, and he'll run all the way back there. So he'll keep ping-ponging back and forth until myself, him, and the subject are united. And at that time in training would be when he would get his reward. And obviously training progression would be working up his nose time for longer and longer problems and more convoluted and crazy scent pictures that forces the dog to use his brain a little bit more. But the concept of teamwork is really critical. You know, when you get certified by the state of New York, and I'm sure this goes for most or all other states, you get certified as a team. Even another certified or operational handler on my team or in the state of New York that goes to the same testing as myself with my dog, if I was injured and my dog is considered a very reliable dog, they could not go out in the field in the state of New York with my dog, because for the relationship that sparked this question. You know, I know the subtleties in my dog's behavior. So when we get into a scent pool, which is an area of concentrated scent that could be an acre or 30 acres, again, depending upon the weather and the terrain and whatnot, you know, my dog, which is working traditionally 40 to 100 yards out in front of me, will come back and he'll circle me. And as he circles me close by, he'll look at me, you know. And when he's out of sight and he's working and he's not in any scent, I'll stand there and I'll wait for him to finish working that area he is. And when he comes back to me and he walks right on by close to me and never looks at me and doesn't circle me, I know he has nothing. And those subtleties, I never taught him that. And every dog that I go out with in the field in search and rescue will say that's an area search dog that does what Quox does. They have these little things that they communicate that are clear as day when you're looking for all these little cues and whatnot. My other dog, Maya, who's a trailing dog, she works on a lead, and she's a scent discriminant dog. So, you know, we give her an article of clothing or keys or whatever has the scent of the subject that we're looking for. And she does trails anywhere from seconds old to several days old, preferably 12 hours or less on real search scenarios. And so she's got to locate and follow a single scent that could be much older amid many scents of other individuals in contaminated areas and stuff. And the communication that goes on in that lead, you know, this might be very similar to mushing, actually, Robert. And the most subtle little line tension, you know, communicates to the dog, you know, basically asking the dog the question, like, do you still have the scent? Are you sure? If I ask the question and the dog doesn't have scent, you know, she'll give me what we call a negative, picks up her head, and she's taught to circle back from the direction we came. All these things come into play. So, you know, the relationship between a dog and the service dog and the handler is, very, very, very sensitive, you know, when you're out in the field. And you really need an experienced trainer can really help guide you through those things. But there's nothing like learning, once you get the dog to that level, learning how the dog communicates with you when it's doing its job.
I totally agree. And Kyle, I would love to have you on another show, and we can talk strictly about search and rescue training and what you do. That is such a fascinating topic to a lot of people. you know, a lot of people really started to understand what search and rescue work, of course, is after 9/11. There were so many profiles of those dog teams on the news and whatnot, and I would love to have you on again to really explore that type of training in depth, because I know that is a true passion of yours. Would you like to be on later for that?
Oh, I would love it. I'd like to say one thing, just to throw it out there, and certainly on that show we could talk about that more in depth. It is my passion, one of my passions, very much so, and something that, including myself, you know, when I got involved in search and rescue, I mean, I like busy dogs. I like active dogs. You know, they complement my personality, and you know. And I'm into working dogs. So when search and rescue kind of crossed my life's path, it seemed really sensible and logical. Like, all right, I'm in the woods. I'm with my dog. I'm going to have a great time. What greater cause could it be for? And even myself, who I consider really real and down-to-earth and level-headed, until I went on my first search, I didn't realize how much of a hobby I felt it was versus a job. And that is something specifically in the realm of search and rescue, because it's completely volunteer activity. I know at least in the state of New York and most places around the country, at least, it's a volunteer activity, and people are looking to do things for a good cause that's fun with their dogs. And I was no different. But when I had to report back to base after having to clear a 200-acre area at night for a missing 4-year-old child in a high probability area, and say that, no, the subject is not in my area, you get a lump in your throat, and you start to realize, you know, the responsibility involved. And I do strongly encourage people with dogs of appropriate capability and background, and the people with the commitment to pursue it, because it's definitely a needed and a terrific service. But there's a lot of responsibility, and it is not a hobby. It's an unpaid job that, hopefully you'll have a lot of fun doing, and you'll enjoy doing the training. I just want to throw that out there, because that is something that, as you move through life and you evolve and you get to certain points, that was something that hit me pretty hard. I've been on several dozen searches now, and that first one, that's really what I learned from that.
Yeah, I was very fortunate, if I might just jump in for a second, that Kyle started to do this while I was filming him. And this was a progression for him and his life, and for me as a filmmaker, to watch him, move through the ranks of his search team and actually go on a couple of searches. And, it's awe-inspiring to see what these animals can do and how they facilitate, the rescue or recovery of people, all over the country.
That's exactly right. And I know you guys showcased, what is his name, Quox, Kyle?
Yes, yeah.
You guys showcased him and how you obtained him. I guess it was from Seattle or somewhere up that way. How is he doing now? How long has it been since that part of the film was done, and I know you had some really high hopes for him, and I know a lot of listeners would like an update.
Yes, Quox was imported into this country from Germany by Kraftwerk Kennels back in May of 2007, and I purchased him in August of 2007. When I originally purchased him, I actually wasn't going to have him be a search and rescue dog. I just purchased him to be a stud for the female that I had just bred him to, actually, over this winter, Maya, my trailing dog. But he was only 2 years old, and he was like, my dream. I like my girls. That old saying, "Mama's boy and daddy's little girl." He's definitely a daddy's boy, but I like my girls, largely speaking, myself. So I got this boy, and he's 2 years old. Had plans to breed him. He's been bred 3 times. We've had phenomenal results with his 3 litters that he's sired. Most of them are in search and rescue homes. 2 of them are on our Ulster County Sheriff's Department and are doing very well. And 6 months, I got him in August. In November, I had already been doing trailing with Maya that year. She was just a year old when Quox came on scene. So when I got into search and rescue, I saw that area search dogs are actually deployed far more than trailing dogs just because of logistics and politics in search and rescue here in New York State. So I was like, well, if I'm going to spend all this time training, I might as well be doing something that's going to be getting deployed most often. So I had this great 2-year-old genetic superstar, so to speak, and in 6 months I had him fully operational for area search, both live and cadaver, and he's terrific. He's very reliable. He's a great dog. I couldn't ask for any more of him.
And the sweetest dog too.
Yeah.
And all of Kyle's dogs, they love people.
Yeah.
You know, they're really, really well dispositioned, which of course is a useful characteristic in search and rescue.
Yeah, sociability is something that certainly in our working service dogs, particularly German Shepherds and military, law enforcement and stuff. You know, as you well know, sometimes we get a little instability, but we want that high drive. You know, we want that, you know, the dog really yearning to hunt and wanting to retrieve all the time. But certainly, you know, we got to have that sociability, and that's something that I think is starting to come back a lot more now in our hardcore working dogs. But you know, it was kind of sparse there for a while, I feel.
I agree. We have one of those high drive German import dogs as well, and that's something I'm not used to. His name is Kane, and I tell you what, I've been a Siberian guy since 1987, and when we brought that guy into our house, I was thrown for a loop, and I've worked with a lot of dogs, but nothing with that high of a drive. And I tell you, you know, that's not the type of dog that is necessarily appropriate for the right, you know, for you know, the home. Those guys are, you know, full of vinegar. They're ready to go. What do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, this is these kinds of dogs are like, I don't let these dogs go to people that I feel that I'm talking to deaf ears about. I mean, you know, I give them the really thorough screening in terms of what their lifestyle is. That's always my thing. What's your lifestyle? What do you like to do? I don't even ask them about the dog. I just ask them, what do you do? You know, this, that, and the other thing. Because people don't change. I mean, they might change for their dog because they love their dog, but I want to know, like, what they do now. You know, outdoor activities, you play cards, you read a book. What do you do? So when I look at these dogs, if I'm talking to deaf ears when I'm really talking about how for the past 100 years, you know, these dogs, which are Schützen 3 dogs, have been bred that way and genetics count, you know, if they're just like, uh-huh, yes, we're falling in love with the little, you know, ball of fur kind of thing, you know, that is not the type of dog for them. They're, you know, they can be sweet, they can be wonderful, but they are, you know, as I always like to say, that's a lot of dogs.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And Kyle, unfortunately, we only have a couple of more minutes, and I do want to have you on very soon to do a show on search and rescue. So if you will, what do you want to close with, and then we'll turn it over to Nick and let him close, and then I'll send you a link over to once we get some of those scratchy parts of this worked out.
Sure. Well, I'm just really thrilled to be on the show. This is my first real interview besides what Nicholas has given me for the film. You know, I live a pretty very busy, on the go local life, but by the same token, it is sheltered within my own sphere, and it's really wonderful to you know, to get some networking with you know, you guys that are, you know, set thousands of miles away, and really identify, because something that I definitely see in and around my community and my state is that you know, there's what I call generic dog training, in the sense that you know, I think anybody can, you know, we're always trying to make a person the best leader they can be, increase their leadership potential, but as you guys well know, you know, certainly if the whole world were, you know, pack leaders, it wouldn't be a very happy place, you know. So it's we don't see a lot of dog trainers that you know, are really focusing on true communication aspects to try to help people. And it really sounds like you guys are trying to do that. And I'm just really, really thankful to have made the connection. So on that note, I do look forward to talking to you in the future, Robert, and being on any one of your shows that seems to fit the bill. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Kyle. We'll be in touch real soon. Nick, we have just a few seconds left. Tell us how we can get in touch with you guys, your website, et cetera.
Sure. Okay, Robert. Thank you both, Robert and Michelle, for having us on the show. The film is Canine Instinct, and the website is www.canineinstinct-movie.com. And, of course, you can just search in any one of the search engines for Canine Instinct Movie or Canine Instinct Kyle or Canine Instinct Nicholas, and you'll get to the website. And we have clips on the website. Unfortunately, we didn't have enough time to play some of the clips that we had provided, but that's fine. Everyone should go see the film, you know, buy the film and check it out. We'd love to hear from you after you watch it. And I just want to say, I think that, you know, the conversation today, that you guys are really onto something. What you guys, Michelle and Robert, are doing in Denver, and what Kyle is doing here in New York, and what I tried to sort of capture and relay in the film is this sense of, you know, dogs being fashionable, or, you know, have a pocketbook dog, you know, and get the dog because you like the way that their coating looks, you know, is not the best way to go about, you know, living your life with a pet. This is an animal that has, you know, personality, it has characteristics, traits, behaviors that you should take seriously and be responsible about, you know, when you buy a dog. And I think that, you know, it's a good thing, this dialogue that we've started, and I hope it continues, because, you know, there's a lot of dogs out there, and there's a lot of people who would love to have a dog, and as long as we, you know, go about matching those up responsibly and people getting the right skills to live a happy life, I think, you know, both the animals and the people will be better off. So that's what I'm trying to portray as far as, you know, the documentary I made about Kyle Warren, and I hope that everyone gets a chance to see the film and enjoys it.
Like I said, we'll do our best to promote the heck out of it for you guys, and we'll repost this show as often as we can. And I appreciate it, Nick and Kyle. It's been a pleasure, and you know how it is in interviews. You only have a certain amount of time that we can be on the air,
yep.
And we'll be back on the air again very soon to talk about search and rescue or whatever else we can get on to talk to a truly inspirational dog trainer like Kyle Warren. And I tell you what, Nick, we need to continue to talk a little bit further about that Iditarod movie that you and I had mentioned, and we'll be sure to see what we can get off the ground with that pretty soon.
Absolutely. Absolutely, Robert. I look forward to it.
I do, too. And again, we hope to talk to you guys very soon. This is Robert Forto. You're listening to the Dog Doctor Radio Show, part of Twine Group Media, and brought to you by Denver Dog Works. We'll be back next week, and we will talk about, I have no idea what, we don't have anything on our schedule yet, but we will make sure that we have something entertaining for you guys very soon. And listen to our show tomorrow on Mush You Huskies, because we are going to reveal where the future home of Team Aneke is. Is it going to be here in Denver, Colorado? Is it going to be up in Anchorage, Alaska? Is it going to be in Toll House, California, or somewhere in Minnesota? So stay tuned to Mush You Huskies on Dog Works Radio. Never forget your dreams. We'll see you next week. Goodbye.